Okay, well, before I launch in, by the way, this is Pentateuch class, so we're making our way through the book of Leviticus, and we're up to chapter 11. I'll remind you that Leviticus is a set of instructions given to the priesthood, but we're going to quickly see as we move ahead that it's not only for the priests and not only for the Levites. I like to say the theme of the book of Leviticus is "Be holy, for I am holy." The I, in that case, being God, not me. But it's about holiness, about the ways that God gave for a physical nation to approach and worship Him through a ritual sacrificial system. And we went through fairly quickly an overview of the different types of sacrifices. And it was very quick in many ways because we don't do those. We realize that they've been superseded by Christ's sacrifice. And we could also say by the spiritual sacrifices that we continue to make. But it's not, as I mentioned, the book is not just for the Levites. And we're moving into a section here where, you know, chapter 11 is, we typically know it as the dietary laws. These weren't for the priests, these were for all of the people. So consider this a break. This isn't part of the ritual sacrificial law, but it's basically part of God showing how He wanted His people to be different. And He constantly says, I want you to make a difference between the holy and the profane. And God revealed that He made some animals to be eaten as food by humans. Contrary to the vegetarian or vegan movement, it seems that God had that in mind all along. But interestingly, though, while He might have made, I believe He did make some food to be, some animals to be food, most of them are not. And how would we know otherwise? Well, God goes out of His way to tell us, you know, what those are. You might make a note, Deuteronomy chapter 14 will repeat these distinctions. And I believe Mr. Creech went over this in doctrines class. I want to make the note that this is not the beginning of these distinctions. It was 1,000 years or so before this that Noah already knew the difference between clean and unclean animals. Am I right on that? What do we know about Noah using making a difference? Yeah, you're on track. As far as bringing animals into the ark, contrary to every children's story you have ever seen, there were not only two of each animal, but there were two of all unclean animals, seven pairs of clean animals. So, and that shows the distinction existed long ago, and as far as we know from the time of Adam and Eve. So anyways, with God having the authority to make these this way, he gave some pretty clear distinctions as to how to tell. Looking in verse 3, well, actually in verse 2, he says, these are the animals which you may eat among all the animals on earth. And then he narrows it down. Among animals, and so animals, he's talking about land-based creatures. How can you tell if there's something you can eat? Okay, they have to have hooves, and what about the hooves? Okay, they have to have divided hooves, or if the old King James, cloven hooves.
The cud.
Okay, say that again with the mic on.
They have to chew the cud.
Okay, they must have a cloven hood and must cheweth the cud. Somehow when it comes to cuds, we have to speak old King James English. Now, since that time, modern science has discovered that they say ruminating animals, which are animals that feed on grass and such and chew the cud, have a more complex digestive systems than others. So it's better at eliminating toxins and all that, making the flesh healthier to consume. Although I'll make the point repeatedly, God does not say that these laws are for health reasons. I'll make the case they have health benefits, but God says, I want you to do this to be holy. So He's giving these laws because they show a difference between the holy and unholy, for His people to be different from all the others. What's the only unclean land animal that's very commonly eaten as food? Okay, pig, swine. Common around the world as far as I know, but that's one that we draw the line. That's where we get noticed the most, am I right? You know, of the two things that make you stand out from others of different religion, what are they? Okay, the Sabbath and, yeah, pepperoni pizza, so to speak. And what's funny is, you know, I started coming to church when I was 10, so I ate pepperoni pizza quite a few times before then. I have no idea of what it tastes like. I don't have that in my memory, but I do have in my memory that I liked it a lot. So whatever that's worth. Okay. What are some animals that we don't commonly eat that we could? I say this just as a matter of trivia. I think it's fun. Giraffe. That's always the top of my list. Of course, deer and elk and things like that, but yeah, giraffe. I keep wondering. I don't know of any society that commonly eats giraffe, but there's part of me now wants to taste it. Okay, I'm going to move on. That's verses 3 through 8 deal with all that. Verses 9 through 12 deal with water creatures. Like the land creatures, for water creatures, there are two pretty easily distinguishable traits, which are fins and scales. I hear it being mumbled. Well, we're all here. We don't have to worry about the recording. Oh, wait a minute. We're recording this for the website, aren't we? So let's remember to use those microphones so Emily won't have to remind us. So note, if you're listening to the recording, several people mumbled fins and scales. Okay, what does that exclude? What can we not eat then? Charlie?
Anything without those characteristics, well, fins and scales.
Okay, I wasn't looking for quite that answer, but that is very accurate. Okay, say that again.
Whales.
Yeah, basically any marine mammal doesn't have fins, am I right? Or doesn't have scales. They do have fins. You can tell I'm out of practice for this. Okay, so yeah, no whales, no dolphins. What else? Andrew?
Sharks.
No sharks. Are there any fish that are commonly eaten as food that we don't?
Catfish.
Danny, you were going for catfish?
Catfish.
That's one, I don't think I've ever tasted catfish. Anybody here had it? It's no different? You can't? Okay. So we trust God. Okay, there's something else that's considered a great delicacy that we don't eat. It comes out of the sea. Julia?
Lobster and shrimp.
Okay. Lobster,
not technically
shrimp.
Fish, but.
In the fish, it is like a kingfish.
What's that?
The kingfish.
Kingfish?
Yeah. It's like a mini shark sort of a thing.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one, but we don't eat it. Is that common in India?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's really common.
So you have to, sky?
Some caviar.
Oh, yeah. I guess caviar is fish eggs. So if it's the eggs of an unclean fish, we would avoid that. Charlie?
Swordfish. And I remember, I don't remember, but I was told in Worldwide that people were actually eating it because they're born with scales, but they fall off as they mature.
Right, and so that's, Sky, did you have a comment on that? Oh, okay. So yeah, that's a discussion. I've heard that the official position of the church has changed because apparently swordfish do have scales and they lose them. I'm not sure, I'd ask, I don't know if you fellas have dealt with that. The last position I heard is that, we say, okay, they're born with scales, they have scales and fins. I'd say it's a matter of if your conscience bothers you, don't eat it. I don't know how often we have opportunity to eat swordfish. I haven't seen it at Kroger lately. Julia?
Just a question, because this popped into my head. Do we eat carp? Does carp have fins and scales?
I believe we can, but most people don't.
They're kind of gross.
Yeah, see, there's a lot of fish that we could eat that don't necessarily make good eating. I think. Oh, yeah, goldfish, or I believe are a type of carp. So anyway, one of the things I want to mention, of course, all shellfish. We mentioned shrimp and lobster and crab and all those things. So going to Red Lobster, it's hard, it's generally a place we don't frequent that much as Christians. So, and that also, of course, eels. And shellfish have been shown to usually have higher levels of toxins than other fish. Once again, a health benefit that's not something God gave. Yes, Mr. Creech? Okay, we listed as unclean. Thank you. So obviously, I'm not up to date. I'm down with that. Like I said, I've never had opportunity, so I didn't have to study and make a firm decision. Grouper, yeah. I'm hesitant now about grouper because of watching Bubble Guppies on TV with Mr. Grouper. Anyway, I'm taking time having fun with this to get back into the flow. Verses 13 through 19, we'll see God did not give a set of easily discernible characteristics for which birds we can eat. Instead, we find here a list of many that we don't. But there is a slight problem with that list. I don't know if Mr. Creech went over that at all. No? Yes? What's the problem with this listing? And I'm not saying it's not an insuperable problem, but it's something to deal with. Well, what I'm getting at is it's a list of names that were listed in ancient Hebrew, and what those names, which species they pertain to now in our modern languages, in some cases there's room for question. Fortunately, there's not a big question. It seems to indicate that pretty much birds of prey and birds that eat carrion are off the list. We don't want to eat those. But pretty much the birds that we commonly do eat in our society are okay to eat. Chicken and turkey being by far and away the greatest, you know, number of those. And that's great because God made them delicious. Duck, goose, pheasant, grouse, pigeon. I don't know of anybody eating pigeon much. Quail, yeah. Isn't quail a form of grouse? I'm not sure. It's a really good blended whiskey, I know that, but famous grouse. People have studied this and found a list of characteristics that seem to apply to birds that are okay to eat. I don't know if Mr. Creech went over those. I think they're listed in the booklet. Did we hand out the booklet? Okay, because if you want these, again, like I said, unless you're, you know, going scavenging in the woods and you're not sure, characteristics of a clean bird, one, it will have a craw or a crop. That's that kind of red thing that hangs down, if I remember correctly. Two, it has a gizzard with a double lining. Three, it is not a bird of prey. Four, it does not eat while flying. Okay, so number five, the hind toe and the middle front toe are elongated. So if you look at its claws, the middle one in the front and the back one are elongated. And when it perches, it'll have three toes on the front and a hind toe on the back. And there might be other characteristics that humans have not been able to figure out, but it seems that God made them that way. For me, I like to say, okay, chicken and turkey are fine. I'm ready to stop there. Verses 20 through 33, God goes on to address what I call flying bugs. Okay, and basically, for the most part, don't eat them. And I think he attaches this to birds, because we tend to see, you know, as it says in verse 20, flying insects that creep on all fours shall be an abomination. Yet, in verse 21, these you may eat of every flying insect that creeps on all fours. There seems to be inherent contradiction in what I just read. Yes? No. What about insects that creep on all fours? If you guys were watching Wildcrats this morning like my son, you'd know. Yes, Kayla?
Do insects have four legs or six?
Insects have six legs, yes. What I want to point out here is the Hebrew here that's translated 4 feet. Actually, scholars say should be interpreted that walks in the manner of a quadruped, meaning walking on, you know, like something that has four. So it's not, the number of legs is not meant to be specified. Otherwise, it would be a contradiction because insects don't walk, you know, on 4 feet. Although some would argue, wait a minute, no, maybe it's because this is addressing that the ones you can eat have two specialized legs, which, as it says there, on verse 21, these you may eat of the flying insects whose creep on all fours, those that have jointed legs above their feet which leap on the earth. And goes on to verse 22, the locust of its kind, the destroying locust, the cricket, the grasshopper. So those, of all the things that we would call bugs, we can eat those. Apparently, they are eaten in the Middle East. I came across an account that said they taste somewhat like herring. And I don't remember exactly what herring tastes like. Herring the fish. Okay, so anyways, apparently a lot of times they're toasted and ground up and then, you know, mixed in with other foods as filler. Anybody here tried grasshopper or locust? Yeah? What'd you think? It's nasty. Okay, I think somebody brought some in a couple years ago and said you could get it at Jungle Gyms. So, hey, Jungle Gyms has everything. I haven't tried it yet. Basically narrows it down. These are the things God said, you can eat this as food. Now, he goes on to specify a bit more about unclean animals, starting in verse 24. By these you shall become unclean. Whoever touches the carcass of any of them shall be unclean until evening. And it goes on all through verse 31, noting that touching the dead body of an unclean animal makes the person ceremonially unclean until evening. What does it mean to be unclean then? I made the point ceremonially unclean. Yes, Andrew?
Is it that they can't go into the temple or at the time the tabernacle? They can't anyway.
Okay, yeah, well, yeah, they can't participate in temple or tabernacle functions. So it's, the uncleanness is related specifically to the ritual system. Okay, and God will go out of his way specifically to mention rodents and reptiles in this section. Don't touch them, don't touch their dead bodies. Now, if you touch them, does that mean you're a sinner and you have to... No, not necessarily. It doesn't say it's a sin, it's ceremonial uncleanness. Better to avoid it, but it's just something you deal with if it comes up. You know, every now and then, if you have a dead possum in your attic, you got to go get it out or else you're going to be smelling it for a long time. So you deal with being unclean until evening. I want to go on verse 32. It says, anything on which any of them falls when they are dead shall be unclean, whether it's an item of wood, clothing, a skin or sack, whatever is in them, in which any work must be done, must be put in water. It'll be unclean until evening, and then it'll be clean. An earthen vessel in which any of them falls, you'll break, whatever it's unclean. And it goes on to describe several, you know, stipulations here, verses 32 through 47. And again, these are related to ceremonial uncleanness, so it's not something that I'm going to ask you to memorize, or I'll confess even that I have memorized. But these designations seem to be largely required. I think, although God doesn't state it, he puts it in terms of, you know, cleanness and the ritual system. All of these rules would also be effective for preventing infection from spreading or remaining. I would say the ceremonial reason is plenty enough. If God says, don't do this or this is excluded, you know, that's fine. But we understand the existence of microbes and how they reproduce and spread and how they can cause illness in a way that God didn't bother to explain to Moses and the Israelites. Although sometimes I wonder if he might have explained it to Moses and then said, don't bother trying to tell them about this, they won't get it. But that's just me guessing. Yes, Kayla?
So it says not to touch dead animals. So were people taxidermists, or was that something that was frowned upon?
That's a good question. I don't know for certain. I mean, I'm not sure when the oldest evidence of taxidermy existed. So it's, yeah. My point would be, though, people could do it and then be unclean till evening. You wouldn't want to do it on Thursday or Friday, you know, Friday morning and then miss going to the temple on the Sabbath or something like that. Because, yeah, I've had the question, and I don't have a perfect answer. Is back when footballs were really made out of pigskin, you know, when does the skin stop being unclean? Does that mean if you play football, you... And I asked this without really never hearing authoritative answer. Charlie?
Kind of a strange question, I guess. My cat recently died. Was I ceremonial unclean till the next evening?
Did you touch it? I would say yes, you were. Okay. Actually, I'm gonna bring something up as we go into the next chapter. I'm sorry, Stephen. Dr. Britt?
So I'd just add that, you know, there's a clear distinction between what was unclean and what was sin. Mm. You know, sometimes things were unclean that were out of your control or that were necessary. Like, you know, if an animal dies in the road, you have to get it out of the road. Mm. You know, and someone has to do that. They have to become unclean. Or there were even times like, you know, if a person died and they were your close relative, you were permitted to go and be near their dead body and become unclean, and it wasn't a sin.
Good point. And that's one of the things to add. Humans are unclean, obviously. We don't have cloven hooves or cheweth the cud. But we do, you know, sometimes have occasion to touch a dead body. We'll see later on, God would put restrictions on for whom a priest was allowed to defile himself with a dead body. It had to be a near relative. Otherwise, you'd get someone else in the family to take care of it. Because they had to maintain that ceremonial purity. Let's move on. In chapter 12, basically, is a set of regulations basically that keep women who have given birth secluded for a time. Verse 2 of chapter 12, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a woman has conceived and born a male child, she shall be unclean 7 days. As in the days of her customary impurity, she shall be clean. That term customary impurity comes up a number of times. It's basically referring to the menstrual cycle, that time of the month that's, well, we don't talk much about. We use that term and then we move on. But it said, like the impurity for that, it says in verse 3, on the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin will be circumcised. Okay, so as the instruction that God gave back in Genesis 17, verse 12, male babies are to be circumcised on the 8th day. But then the woman's seclusion continues. Verse 4, she'll continue the blood of her purification 33 days. Shall not touch any hallowed thing, nor come into the sanctuary until the days of her purification are fulfilled. It goes on now, though, to say that if she has a female child, The period is double. She has 2 weeks for her customary impurity and continue in the blood of her purification for 66 days. Why twice as long for a female as for a male baby? I have no idea. Yes, Sky?
My stepmom puts her own little interpretation on it, saying, well, since, because the females were not as sought after as the boys were, so maybe it was a chance to be like, okay, well, if you had a female, here's a chance just to have extra break with it. It was just her own twist on it.
It's an interesting thought, because I was going to say, the Bible doesn't give us an explanation, and I haven't seen anybody point to another place in Scripture that would be a good interpretation. I'm open to ideas, but it's one of those things that it's not quite explained. Neither is the ceremonial term of, you know, uncleanness after. You know, you have the week or the 2 weeks, and then that month or 2 months afterwards. Why that, you know, in the first place, let alone that it's doubled for the woman? It's not really explained. It seems to be related to what we'll see later in chapter 15, that God will make the case that pretty much any time something's coming out of your body that's not normal, it would make you ceremonially unclean. And when I say you, I'm talking about them. So, you know, the things we do every day, which I know during breaks we all participate in that, things come out of our body and that doesn't create ritual uncleanness. But almost anything else that's not a normal basis does do that. And again, we could speculate reasons of health, hygiene, and such, but God doesn't really describe that, but he does relate it to the pure ritual system. Now, one of the questions I was going to say that we're going to get to, how do we relate that to our modern terms? Because I've heard people say this, like, okay, if it's, you know, say a woman's time of the month, maybe she shouldn't come to church services because the church is the temple of God, and we're saying here you can't go to the temple or relate in temple functions. Should we be relating that to our modern practice today? Okay, it's a valid question, because I've known some people who've said the answer is yes, and you know, it's not common. It's not a teaching of the United Church of God or any major group that I know of. Okay, I guess in some ways I'm glad I'm not getting an argument on this. one of the strongest reasons to say no, that doesn't apply, is we're dealing with a spiritual temple today, made holy by the presence of the Holy Spirit. We speak of the church as a whole as being that, but the New Testament also shows that our bodies individually are described as being that. Each one of us is considered a temple of the Holy Spirit, or part of the temple. So, you know, say you're impure for whatever reason, could be male or female, you can't suddenly stop being a part of the church. God doesn't cut off his Holy Spirit and say, oh, you're excluded now during this time of unholiness. Do you see what I'm... or time of ritual uncleanness. So I would make the case that this is related to that physical system and the exclusion applied to a physical thing that doesn't translate into our participation in the church today. I have a feeling that there's more that could be said, and perhaps I'll grow to greater understanding of this, but the Bible, you know, it leaves it kind of vague. In the New Testament, yes, Dr. Britt, the New Testament doesn't really outline it step for step, but please go ahead.
So one thought, and like you said, this is not really developed as much in the New Testament explicitly, but the fact that our cleansing comes through Jesus Christ, you know, the process of cleansing still exists in the New Testament, but, you know, it gets kind of lumped in with the forgiveness of sin, and it's hard to separate out the ideas as you read through.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it, you know, that way, we don't have to go through a week-long purification and sacrifice a bird here and a lamb there and do all these things. Yeah. We have the one sacrifice that cleanses all sin.
That's a good point. Yeah, and all impurity, we could say. We're cleansed by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And like I said, Dr. Britt said correctly, it's not fleshed out step by step, partly because that's not, you know, this ancient ritual system was made for people without the Holy Spirit as a way of understanding God's differentiation, that he was holy and they needed to be different from societies around them. And so not everything has a direct parallel in the modern church, at least to my understanding, and I'm still growing and ask God continually to open my eyes to this. But yeah, where there is cleansing and purification, we do understand it to be related to the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And so that's done once for all. You know, we don't have to wring a bird's neck and dip the other one in its blood and let it loose. And I say that, we have those coming up. Verse 8, I will make note of one thing. Because there was a certain sacrifice when, after giving birth, the woman went through that system, then they would come and offer an offering to show the purification. And for those who were poor, it's important enough that God allowed, you know, two turtle doves to be brought instead of the larger animals. And that sticks out in my memory because that's exactly what Joseph and Mary did in her purification after Jesus was born. You see that in Luke 2, verses 22 to 24. So that tells us just something about their family. Apparently, they weren't rolling in dough, but then again, they'd picked up and moved to Bethlehem from Galilee and were, you know, I don't know if Joseph was doing as much work those days. Anyways, boy, I'm going kind of slow, but I kind of wanted to today. I want to move in chapter 13. I'm going to summarize. This is another place where we could get into a lot of detail. And we could draw an analogy. As a matter of fact, I'll reference you. Dr. Britt has given a sermon based on this that I found interesting, and I believe you can get the recording online. So I won't go into as much detail, but the idea of our cleansing through Christ's sacrifice is a major point there. To look at the physical, though, we're going to see that Scripture reveals the priest would have some other duties besides as religious leaders and offering sacrifice. Here we see them described as what I would call public health officers. The priesthood and the Levites working with them served to serve the public as, you know, I use the term public health officers, not doctors. You know, they did not treat disease to keep individuals healthy. So they didn't treat particular disease in individuals, but they did impose the practice of quarantine to keep the general population healthy. So this is still about keeping people healthy, but it's about looking at the population as a whole. And you get into this in chapter 13. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When a man has on the skin of his body a swelling, a scab, or a bright spot, and it becomes on the skin of his body like a leprous sore, he'll be brought to Aaron and the priest, or Aaron the priest, or to one of his sons of the priest. And the priest will examine the sore on the skin of his body. If the hair is turned white or it appears to be deeper than the skin, it's a leprous sore. The priest shall pronounce him or shall examine him and pronounce him unclean." Okay, so we have some things that can happen. One is going to say, okay, you're obviously unclean. You need to be isolated. He might look and say, well, let's see what happens. In verse 4, if the bright spot, you know, on the skin of his body does not appear to be deeper than the skin, the hair hasn't turned white, then the priest will isolate the one who has the sore 7 days. So set aside 7 days, stay to yourself, I'll come back and check you then. The priest will examine him on the seventh day. If the sore appears to be as it was, the sore is not spread, he'll isolate him another 7 days. Then the priest will examine him again the seventh day, and indeed, if the sore is faded and the sore is not spread on the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him clean. It's only a scab, he'll wash his clothes and be clean. But if the scab should be at all spread on the skin after he's seen by the priest, he shall be seen by the priest again. And if the priest sees the scab is indeed spread, the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It's leprosy. Okay, we'll come back and look at this as an overview. What is leprosy? Okay, Sky, as we know it today anyways, or...
Is that where your like skin rots away? And
okay, it's...
Like at the nerves and everything?
Yeah, the classic definition of leprosy. It's known modern times... as Hansen's disease also. Which, if my memory is correct, it's caused by a bacterial infection. Nate?
You say you get it from armadillos, but that's not true. That's a rumor.
Okay, I haven't heard that one, and I lived in Texas for several years. Okay, I know Hansen's disease is a chronic contagion, bacterial infection. It can have various effects on people. It can cause skin lesions, discoloration, often white. It can affect interior functions as well that aren't as known. But it seems to result in deteriorating cartilage, which is why, you know, and, well, apparently noses would tend to be lost and parts of ears first. It could cause blindness. Interestingly, they say the traditional Hansen's disease did not that often cause death. But it would weaken people so they would often die of a secondary infection. Now, Hansen's disease, as we know it today, is not all that easily contagious, modern doctors say. And I'll make a mention, I don't know if he'll do it again this year, but I know last year in Gospels class, Mr. Ashley discussed leprosy quite a bit, and he showed some pictures and such, which I'm not going to do. Yeah, he did that, and his point was to show how big a deal it was that Christ would touch lepers, and that's not something inconsiderable. What I want to make the point of here is we see the term leprosy, you know, that's a word from English from thousands of years later. Here, it's likely that that term is referring to perhaps a range of diseases, especially communicable diseases, or you could say contagious. I find neither of those easy to spell in a hurry. So it doesn't have to be necessarily just Hansen's disease. Basically, it's saying, okay, go to the priest and there's something on you that's spreading and it's probably contagious. If the priest determines that an infection is active and spreading, the person has to be isolated. Jump to verse 22. Actually, I've got that in my notes. If it should at all spread over the skin, the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It's a leprous sore. If the bright spot stays in one place and is not spread, it's a scar of a boil, the priest shall pronounce him clean. So something that's spreading, it needs to be isolated. I noted the priest would check again. You know, we read that, you know, set aside for a week, then check again. So we see a couple of things. One is that it required actual inspection. The priest didn't just hear a rumor, he went and saw himself. You know, and it also shows that, you know, a person should seek help. You know, if they have, what's going on with me? I should, you know, don't keep it to yourself or hide it necessarily. Now, one of the things I think of, you know, we all have something, sometimes you find something on you or you feel bad. Have you ever called a doctor the day you start feeling bad? And what do they tell you? Yeah, wait. A lot of times they say, give it 7 to 10 days, then if it's still around, then come and see me. Because a lot of diseases come, they run their course, and 7 to 10 days, or, you know, a lot of bad viral infections might be up to a couple weeks, but a lot of things will be gone in that time. And so I think it's interesting that God knew that in advance. I shouldn't say interesting, it's obvious. God knows all these things. So he's following a similar procedure that doctors have found seems to work. Verse 13 strikes me as interesting. It says, if the priest shall consider, and indeed, if the leprosy has covered all his body, he'll pronounce him clean who has a sore. It's all turned white. He is clean. In some cases, you know, you could have a plague, something all over affecting you, but not necessarily be contagious. And that seems to be the case here. So it doesn't mean that you're not sick, but you don't have to be quarantined. So, you know, we have a lot of these. Verses 29 to 39 discuss, you know, characteristics to look for. And it mentions that skin diseases can affect hair. You know, so the hair might fall out, it might change color, you know, so that is included. But verse 41 makes an interesting point. Verse 40, as for the man whose hair has fallen out from his head, he's bald, but he's clean. So losing your hair, baldness does not indicate uncleanness. And he makes the distinction of forehead baldness. It seems interesting to me that these were considerations thousands of years ago, just as they are today. And there's no mention of whether or not Propecia was available. Okay. Oh, I want to go to verse 45. So we want to note there's still an obligation on the person that is unclean, who has this leprosy. Verse 45, the leper on whom the sore is, his clothes will be torn, his head bare, and he'll cover his mustache and cry, unclean, unclean. He'll be unclean all the days he has the sore and be unclean. He is unclean. He shall dwell alone. His dwelling will be outside the camp. So, you know, the person is unclean because of their disease, and thus they have to let it be known. So they have to have a particular appearance. Now, there where it says mustache, sometimes the translation is upper lip, or basically refers to covering your mouth. Nowadays, they get one of those white masks that you see, probably. But the idea is you don't go around breathing on people and spitting on them and sneezing. You cover up, and if someone's coming near, say, oh, I'm unclean, I'm unclean. Nowadays, you ever have that? You have a cold or you've got the flu, you tell people, don't come near me. You know, my Sue will do that when she was down sick during the time we were at Winter Family Weekend. And, you know, sometimes we put Connor to bed. She said, I'm not going to kiss you goodnight tonight. And I still remember my mom doing that to me. I have a cold. I'm not going to kiss you. Well, you know, when you're 7 years old, you don't always understand that. But later on, you're very thankful. So this doesn't refer to being publicly humiliated so much as the person who has a disease, you know, showing consideration of others. Keep away from them, let them know. So I don't think it means they had to go around all the rest of their life saying, unclean, unclean, unclean. You know, it'd be hard to get any sleep. But as you approach others, you would let them know. Now, I look at this, you know, the spiritual part of this, and again, I think Dr. Britt made a good case of our cleansing comes through Christ's sacrifice. And we're going to talk about, you know, there's an elaborate ritual system for when the leper is healed and cleansed. But we don't institute all of these practices. We don't have a priesthood, but we do have, I would say, superior science for diagnosis. You know, when I go to the doctor, he doesn't look and say, that looks kind of reddish, I'm not sure if it's spreading. Go stay in your closet for 7 days and I'll come look again. You know, we can do various tests and things. But the underlying principle of not spreading sickness is something I think does apply to us. In love for other people, we should isolate ourselves when we know we have something that could cause harm to other people. And you probably heard that at church a lot number of times. If you're sick, stay home, you know. And that would apply even here. Yeah, Sky?
What if it's a child outside the city? They say if you have leprosy, but if it's a child, the child can't take care of themselves.
Well, I'd say then the parents probably have to go with them. I guess it doesn't address that, but I don't think that it's ever implied that, you know, kids drop their, or the parents drop their kid off outside of town and say, yeah, see ya, good luck. So yeah, there's some sacrifice in that case. It's a good thought. It's not specifically addressed, but I think that's true. Anything else? Because we're going to move to some other stuff, but actually, starting in verse 47, we'll see, also if a garment has a leprous plague, whether it's a woolen garment or a linen garment, whether it's in the warp or woof of the linen or wool, or whether leather or anything made of leather, and it goes on to describe that the plague is greenish or the garment. Here the term leprosy seems to be referring to some type of infection in material, in clothing. What might that include? It's not Hansen's disease, although I guess bacteria can live in a number of things. Kayla?
Maybe mold?
Okay, mold is a good guess. Maybe some other type of fungus. Is mold officially a fungus? I was thinking, okay, because in my notes I've got mold, fungus. We might say perhaps even a mite or a type of insect infestation. Any of these things could cause discoloration and such. And it goes on to describe that first you can try washing. Washing might eliminate the problem. It'd be handy if they had bleach back then. I'm not sure that they did. If not, burning wood. Okay, and so that the ultimate thing is if you got something that's got this mold or something growing in it, if you can't, it doesn't wash out, it won't stop spreading, you burn it. But you stop the spread. As I mentioned before, Moses and the people of his time probably didn't understand microbes. But we can understand the appreciation of quarantine as a tool for that. I find it interesting, if you look through history, especially in the Middle Ages, Jewish communities that were aware of and practiced these rules, at least to the extent they could, they didn't have the temple, but they tended to not as often experience as much sickness and death. Matter of fact, notably when the bubonic plague was sweeping Europe, sometimes the Jewish communities wouldn't have it as much. I think because they're practicing quarantine and other hygiene matters. You know, God, I say later on we'll see in Deuteronomy, God specifically says basically dig a latrine outside the camp and, you know, does it take an instrument? I like it, the old King James says, has a paddle on your sword and when something comes out of you, cover it up. You know, so practice good hygiene, sewage treatment and things like that. You know, the sad thing is the Jewish communities that practiced these types of things and thus avoided sickness many times came under persecution because then the others would accuse them of causing the plague or practicing witchcraft to avoid it. So they wouldn't suffer from the sickness, but people would come and start killing them. Now, that didn't happen in every case. And so we see clear benefits from practicing these types of things. Moving on into chapter 14, we're going to see that when a leper is declared clean, he has to make a special offering. Verse 14, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, this shall be the law of the leper for the day of his cleansing. He'll be brought to the priest. The priest will go out to the camp and examine him, and if indeed the leprosy is healed in the leper, then the priest shall command to take for him who is to be cleansed two living and two clean birds, cedar wood, scarlet, and hyssop. And I'll let you read that. It's interesting that there's a particular offering that has to be given before the quarantine completely ends. So the offering has to be done another 7 days outside the camp. This still happened. There's an example in Luke 17. Remember when Christ healed some lepers, he said, go make the offering as commanded by Moses. So this apparently was in place all that time, and there's no reason to think it wouldn't be. And this is a fairly unique sacrifice intended to acknowledge God's healing. And as I said, we've said it can represent the cleansing that comes from Christ's sacrifice. There had to be two birds. They have to be both living and clean birds, so the type of birds you could eat. It doesn't say that, but the types of birds that would be used in sacrifice were turtle doves or pigeons. Now, they have to, in verse 6, the living bird, you'll take it, the cedar, the scarlet, dip them in the living bird. Oh yeah, actually I wanted verse 5. One of the birds will be killed in an earthen vessel over running water. The running water, it makes it sound like you have to go do it over top of a creek or a stream. But the Hebrew there is literally living water. Now, I don't think living water is symbolic of the Holy Spirit, but in the physical usage there, it meant water that's not stagnant, it's running. But that means you could go dip some of that water out, bring it back, and then do the ceremony at a convenient place instead of hanging out over a bridge or something. At least that's what many people would think. Okay, so then you take the scarlet, the hyssop, and the bird that's still alive, and you tie them to this cedar stick. Some scholars say juniper was the actual translation. And they say the live bird, probably with the tail feathers pointing down. But I wonder what the live bird is thinking. You know, you're tying it to a stick, and then you dip it in blood of the other bird, and then you let it free. It's a common thought that the bird flying away would be symbolic of the disease leaving the person. Matter of fact, let's... Yeah, at the end of verse 7, you know, you sprinkle seven times. This is the running water that's had the other things dipped into it. Sprinkle on the leprosy. It'll be pronounced clean. Let the living bird loose in the open field. And he probably took great care to never be caught again. And he was cleansed, will wash his clothes, shave off all his hair, wash himself in water that he may be clean. And after that, he'll come into the camp and stay outside his tent 7 days. And on the seventh day, he'll shave the hair of his head and his beard and his eyebrows. All his hair he'll shave off, wash his clothes, wash his body in water, and he'll be clean. So again, all this shaving seems to represent ritual cleaning. Might also have good hygienic purposes, because we know hair can be full of dirt and bacteria and stuff like that. I just thought, since I've been growing my beard, I remember I had a colleague once who was a professor at University of Akron, and he wore a big full beard, and he said people were always criticizing him. He said a woman looked at him and said, do you ever wash that thing? I said, well, I wash it like you wash your hair. What are you talking about? But anyways, that's totally off the subject. So this is done, and then there would be a sacrifice, starting in verse 10. On the eighth day, so after a 7 days seclusion, he'll take two male lambs without blemish, and a ewe lamb of the first year without blemish, and 3/10 of an ephah of flour mixed with oil as a grain offering, 1 log of oil. A log is thought to have been a little more than a cup. I'm not sure exactly how the word log came into the translation, but it's about that volume of oil. So the leper has to offer 3 lambs as a sacrifice. Now, no substitute animal is acceptable for one of them. He has to do a lamb, but later in verses 21 through 32, it'll show that if the person is poor, they can offer 2 turtle doves with the 1 lamb. So the 1 lamb, it has to be that, but instead of the other 2, it could be a couple of turtle doves. And I'm going to summarize this quickly and we'll take a break. Because one of the interesting features of this is that the blood and then later the oil will be put on the cleansed leper the same way that the oil was put on Aaron and his sons when they were consecrated to the priesthood. some on the right thumb, some on the right toe, and some on the right ear. If I remember, first the blood, then the oil. And I say, if I remember, it's in here. Yeah, verse 14. The priest will take some of the blood of the trespass offering, put it on the tip of his right ear of him who is cleansed, the thumb of his right hand, the big toe of his right foot. And then the oil comes, yes, over in verse 27. No, it's that's where it's sprinkling in. And verse 28, you put it on the thumb, the big toe, and the right ear. That also is not explained. It seems that blood represents forgiveness of sin and cleansing from impurity. The oil seems to perhaps represent God's healing. And I mention that particularly because we know in James 5:14 that our modern practice, is when we want to request God's healing, is that an elder will anoint with oil. So here, oil is used to show apparently that healing, you know, after the fact. Aren't you guys glad you don't have to do this after you have the flu or bad case of eczema or anything like that? Any questions on this? Because I think I'm going to take a break here in the middle of a chapter because we're going to switch to dealing with houses after this.